This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We are featuring two preeminent women poets today, and they are Myra Sclareau and Judith Farr. And the first person we'll hear from is Myra with an opening poem.
Impasse. Here a crow pours over the still warm body of a squirrel as if over sacred text. Plucks scraps of entrails like holy words. What does it read in the long history of prophecy? Perhaps the slick remains their iridescent blood trail, like a map marking off boundaries, still speak, saying, what more did you expect? This crow can lift up above the bloodied streets, in a moment rise into purifying blue, innocent as the sun, delivered off this contaminated earth. Once I swept up into the sky, bombs exploding beneath me. I left your world of war and blood on the stones and entered the seed of unholy innocence.
That's the voice of Myra Sclareau. What book is that from? She doesn't know because she tore the pages out of the books to bring to the studio. I'm looking at pages.
That was in a
The Ants, the book about that had the ants in the title.
No, it was in actually a literary magazine. Oh, it hasn't been in a book yet.
That's Myra Sclareau. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. And here is who she is. She's an American poet, former president of YADO, which is an artist community. And she's the author of 3 chapbooks, 6 collections of poetry, most recently Lithuania, New and Selected Poems. And a new book is yet to come out. It is, the galleys are due December 1st. What's the title of that book?
Holocaust and the Construction of Memory.
Myra was trained as a scientist, and she was educated at Tufts, where she studied biology, and she was at the Cold Spring Harbor Biological Laboratory, where she studied bacterial genetics and bacterial viruses, and she's still very active. And as she's retired from America, she's still now plunging back into the world of science. I would like to just mention the Holocaust and the Construction of Memory first because it's a profound paper, soon to be a book. What is memory?
It's interesting. People are beginning to really ask what memory is. We used to think that in scientific terms that it was encoding, storing, and retrieving experience and information. But then that left out how we learn. So memory is a complicated issue. We're beginning to understand how the brain takes in experience, what it does with it, and how we learn from it.
So you use the Holocaust, which is one of your fields of study, to identify what happens to memory from these survivors. And that was your template, really, wasn't it?
My interest was what happened in traumatic memory, what happened in trauma. Why is it that a man who witnessed 10,000 people being marched off to be killed as a child, when he was a child, all he has to do is see a horizontal line to immediately feel panic without any warning? I was curious about why we are subject to the earlier trauma as if we are still there So that began my interest, and also wandering in the villages of Lithuania and talking to survivors and rescuers and others.
This is a brilliant book, and when might it be published?
Well, the book goes to the publisher in December, if it's done in time, and then I guess shortly thereafter.
And will it be called Holocaust and the Construction of Memory?
So that's been the working title, but we'll see.
She's Myra Sclareau. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. We have been friends for many years, and here is her poem.
Harmless. I want to lie down on the earth like my cat, to roll over on my back and let the sun walk across my face. Magdalena Abakanovitz says art is harmless. Stalin was a poet. Hitler was a painter. Says art is the space between wisdom and madness. It opens our brains to imagining. In this poem, I ask the anxiety of early morning to stand aside, like a good soldier who draws back his bayonet and allows me to pass by. In this poem, I ask that the transport of frozen children be transformed, that in the morning when they come to unlock the ice-covered door, from each golden chrysalis a living child will emerge, that the artist between dreaming and reality opens our eyes and places before us 20 girls intact.
That's Myra. I'm Grace. Some of her other books are The Witness Trees. Then there was a collection of short fiction, Like a Field Riddled by Ants. There was Over the Rooftops of Time, Essays. And her book, Eating the White Earth, was translated into Hebrew by Moshe Dor and has been published in Israel. She has been teaching at American University for 30-plus years. And during that time, I saw you get in touch with your ancestry in Lithuania. So can you just hark back and just tell us when that past became inflamed enough for you to want to actually go there and pursue it?
I think by accident. I had an opportunity, having run an artist colony at Yaddo in Saratoga Springs, to help someone in Italy, in Umbertide, set up an artist colony in an 11th century castle. And when I was in Italy, I thought, well, Lithuania can't be too far away. And by then, communism had ended. And so I got on a plane and ended up in Vilnius and began to wander around the country. And I've been doing that for 14 years. I've been there 10 times and spent several months each time and have talked to villagers all over the country.
And you just embarked with a spiral notebook and began?
Without a plan. Yeah. My mother's people are from there, so that was the motivation.
Well, we have the Lithuania poems, but where are the memoirs about that process? Are they coming up?
I haven't really done memoirs. I think in the Holocaust book, you'll find some of the wanderings and some of the reasons why I was there. But it's not so much a personal book as it is a study.
Well, we want to honor it when it comes out. There are, I guess, next to poetry, Holocaust studies are the least noticed and supported. And that has, so I thank you very much for what you're doing. And you can thank us by giving us a poem.
I thought I'd go a different direction this time. When I was working at Yaddo, the artist colony, we had a cook there who was born in Labrador. And when she was 13, she was sent to Newfoundland to work in the home of a family. And during that time, the house caught fire and part of the family died. And she used to tell me stories, and so this is her story. And I always hear it in her voice, so I can't help but sort of sound the way she did. Nell's story. Oh, I opened my eyes all right, and it was light greeted me, light rising up, and I went to see what could be causing it, and it was fire causing it. My scream went out of me without asking permission. Oh, my scream tumbled out of me until even I couldn't tell where it was coming from. The others slept in a room off the kitchen. I screamed and ran out the house in my bare feet. It was 20 below, and ran round to the back of the house and tapped on their window. The husband got up and broke the glass. I could see the wife moving in the room. She came near the window carrying the infant in her arms. But when I looked next, there was no infant, only the shoulders of the wife coming toward me through the window. I pulled on her arms and her shoulders to fit her out through the broken glass, and the smoke came billowing out behind her, but there was no baby in her arms. And the thud I heard, was it the husband going down to the floor or the baby she dropped as she came through the window? And what did the wife think when she got out in the snow? And the sound, what sound did the baby make? And what did the husband say eating his dinner of smoke and flames? What did my feet say running in the snow? And what did the dog say when I fell among them, running to safety and fallen on the ground, the dog scrambling over me, while I propped myself up on the hindquarters of one of them and rose up tall and went on running? And what did my feet say all those months, poor feet who didn't belong to their shoes? Oh, my feet who didn't belong to their shoes. And the baby who fell with a thud on the floor, and the husband eating his supper of fire and smoke.
Wow, she talked in polyphonic prose.
Right.
You were the head of Yaddo for how many years?
4.5 years.
As intense a person as you are and as passionate about everyone's comfort, how in the world did you survive? I mean, you had to think about even the cook and the meals. What did you do as president?
Well, one day we were getting ready to serve the meal for the artists in the beautiful Victorian mansion, and I noticed the floor was sinking into the basement. And of course, the artists were in paradise and were never to know of anything difficult. So I went to the basement, saw that the wooden timbers had been eaten by termites. The metal supports that had replaced them were eroded by water. I got my men to go down to the building supply store and get hoists. And we hoisted up the floor, made the butterballs, and served dinner.
That's what the president does.
That's what the president
does. Now, what are the fun things that you did?
Well, we used to fly airplanes over the property to make sure nobody was sort of filling in our wetlands, because we were sitting on 450 acres of prime real estate that everybody wanted a piece of, and next door to the oldest racetrack in the country. So
where is it?
Saratoga Springs, New York.
What did you learn from that experience about yourself as an administrator?
I learned that women who run households can run anything, and this was just a household gone to heaven, so that if you just multiplied every single thing you had to do at home, you'd be an expert at this.
Have you written that essay, Household
No.
Gone to Heaven?
No.
But were you happy to come home again?
I was, and I was very happy to be there. I think that the American form of patronage, which is slim indeed for the arts, in its artist colonies, which are usually set up by individuals, are remarkable support for artists, and I loved doing that work.
And you loved teaching, which we will go into after the next poem. Myra Scleru is here. I am Grace Cavalieri. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress.
A poem about parenthood, poem of the mother. The heart goes out ahead, scouting for him, while I stay at home, keeping the fire, holding the house down around myself like a skirt from the high wind. The boy does not know how my eye strains to make out his small animal shape, swimming hard across the future, nor that I have strengthened myself like the wood side of this house for his benefit. I stay still so he can rail against me. I stay at the fixed center of things like a jar on its shelf, or the clock on the mantle, so when his time comes, he can leave me.
Your poems, many of them are remembered poems. How does memory factor into poetry, as your studies show memory reveals loss? What's the difference in the poet's memory and the memory that you found, that you studied scientifically for the Holocaust survivors? I mean, is the pain... Do we access the pain where the survivor of really trauma cannot?
I think there are some similarities that when you experience trauma, it's now thought that part of the brain, the amygdala, provides kind of emotional valence for incoming experience. And so, but it also inhibits the hippocampus, which provides space and time. It provides the context of spatial, where you are and when you are there. So that's inhibited. And what you get in traumatic memory are flashes and fragments and pieces. And I think the poet, at least the way I write, and I think many other writers, write not so much out of conceptual things, but because they have flashes of images. Mm. And I think that there may be some similarity. Maybe our amygdalas are working more full-time. They're like the images of dreams, and I think that we're more sensitive to those images, and we capture them. Everyone has them, but I think that writers are scouting for them more.
So if you did an MRI on our brains, as you were talking about before we went on mic, how wonderful the tools are,
yes,
you might see poets' brains as being different.
I would think so, yes.
Maybe.
Yeah.
That would be your
so.
Next assignment. Not enough to do. Myra Scleru. And one more poem, and then I have a host of questions.
Okay.
Although I've known you for 35 years, I haven't had a chance to ask all these.
This is a poem about teaching. Teaching. What do I know about teaching? That Linnaeus, our latter-day Adam, wandered in the world gloriously naming things until he forgot his own name. Or that Cuvier turned the key in the great chain of being until time, like a fresh wind, made us a family. Once a man named Abbo spent 2 semesters pulling me through the stuff of analytic geometry. I was squandered on it. And when I signed up for poetry, the card came back, "You are fully registered for millimeter wave optics." What did I know about the physics of light? I grow nervous. I have nothing to tell them. Tell them what you know, a voice urges, and the adage I have made for myself surfaces. I am, I begin again, a scientist, but I teach literature. And later, in another room, my students, my shield, I will be someone schooled in literature talking science.
That's perfect for you. After being trained in biology, you then worked at Johns Hopkins with Elliot Coleman, the great one.
Yes.
And from there, you combined both of those talents and began working in 1970 at American.
That's right.
Yeah, as a full professor. And then I remember in your writings one wonderful thing where you said you taught the first Vietnam veterans that
right.
came back. Well, since teaching's always a surprise, what surprises did they give you as they studied with you?
That was a very instructive time in my life in 1970. The first students were Vietnam vets. They were unrehabilitated. Some of them were drug addicted, very traumatized. It was an unpopular war. They were not well treated when they returned home. In the classrooms, they had difficulty with control. I was immensely touched by them. I wanted to help them in any way I could. They could barely manage in a classroom situation. One of them became very important in a head of an organization called the Vietnam Veterans Against the War.
Who was that?
Stephen Sober.
Oh.
Very excellent young man. Some recovered and some did not. And I think about that now as we watch our young people coming back from Iraq. And nothing has changed. The same issues, except with these young people, they're surviving because we have better ways to help them survive. So they're much more damaged. So it's very complicated.
I remember you saying that one Vietnam veteran that you didn't really understand, you had assigned Dante to him.
That was an amazing story. I had this student who'd just come back from Vietnam, and he used to stand in the back of the hall as we waited to get into the classroom, always closest to the escape, but closest to the stairway so he could get out. One day he hands me a packet of papers and it says, I'd like you to read this. And I said, I'll try. And of course, I went home 5 minutes later and read everything. We'd been studying Dante, and he had never told anyone about his experiences, in which he was in a reconnaissance group, so they were on the front lines, and he was eventually lifted into a helicopter from a ring of fire where all of his men were killed, and he had never talked about it or done anything about it. Reading Dante when he descended into the inferno gave him a way to think about his experience, and then he wrote about it. And then he actually published the work. I think New York Magazine was doing pieces by Vietnam vets. And he told me that he had gotten his lawyer to look into it. And I said, how could you have a lawyer? He had no money. He drove a taxi cab and stuff. He said, my father went back to school to in his late 60s to study civil rights law. And so his father was a student. And he took him up to New York and got him published in this magazine.
So education matters a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But ever in the way you think. You thought you were teaching Dante. And you're teaching a soul, a human soul.
And when you're teaching, you don't realize sometimes that some critical life is in your hands, and you might miss it. I could have said no, I don't have time, but I thought how delicate that was, and it opened a whole door for this young man and for all of us.
Are you emerita now?
I am
professor.
I'm also working pretty full-time over there.
I know you told me that being retired was hard work.
Very hard
12 work. Hours a day instead of nine.
Right.
Myra Sclareau is who she is, and we're at the library. And here's another poem.
A poem, The Infinite Regress of War, for Sinan Antun, born in Baghdad. In the mirror of infinite regress, go back to Vietnam, to a man who can spot a tripwire fine as a hair, thread to explosives, who keeps his body close to an escape route. Only Dante can help him find his words. In the infinite regress of war, start anywhere. Try Rwanda, Baghdad, the Persian Gulf. Try Phnom Penh, a man left an eye in a jungle there. Try Korea, or a man shot down over Germany. We welcome back the parts of him that survived. In the closed system of infinite regress, not even a hatchet can begin the excavation. sepulcher of repeated images. Won't someone shatter the pure reflection of glass? Here comes the poet who sees a mother weaving a shroud, not Penelope staving off her suitors for Ulysses' eventual return, but a shroud for another war, a shroud for the dead man still in her womb. Poet, if I put your words inside my poem, have we not crossed over into one another, escaped the endless hierarchy of war, or must we stumble again against the mirror at noon?
Studying at Yale in the School of Medicine, and you were actually studying brains then, monkeys' brains.
I was a research assistant working with a remarkable man named Carl Prebram, looking at frontal lobe function of the brain and memory with monkeys, catching monkeys in cages.
And years later, you're putting that to use.
Absolutely.
And you said, however, when you go to NIH now and you see the tools they have, you wish you could have plunged full frontal into science.
I do wish, if I had another life to live, I do wish that I could begin again and study neuroscience. The field is exploding now, and we have the tools to explore it, and I would love to do that.
But where do science and literature fit together?
I always think of them exactly in the same way. They're both processes. They're both things, hypotheses that you test out, words that you put on a page to see where they're going to take you. Some of the most wonderful things we've learned in science happen because somebody observed something as an accident. The simplest one is penicillin, looking at a mold that wasn't supposed to be there and then paying attention to it. So many things. Or Kekula, who kept, we thought in his day that the carbon compounds were linear in their makeup. And one night he dreamed that a snake grasped its own tail, and he saw this circle and realized that the carbon ring is in fact not linear, but it's a circle. So observing, dreaming, following your nose in a certain way to see what's going to happen.
But one is observable and literature really is not. So that exactly, I mean, the imagination may come to play in both of them, but in literature, your poetry, how much do you think is imagined? You do write a lot of anecdotal poetry, though, about
I do think it's imagined, but I think that that poets and writers tend to follow out what they imagine rather than any kind of prescribed formula. And I think scientists do the same thing.
That's a good point. Yeah.
I think scientists spend a lot of time doing very hard bench work.
I know.
But I think they also pay attention to what occurs to them, the sort of unexpected occurrence.
My cousin's a global guy at NASA, and they asked him to have a shadow student that can watch him all day.
Right.
And all he did was sit there and think. And so the student had nothing to write up. Myra, let us see what you thought on that page that I'm looking at. Myra Scleru.
This is a poem that's still being written, so you'll hear a draft. Vocation. The boy's job is to collect body parts. He brings them to the combat hospital, watches the wounded come in, spent artillery shells packed with broken glass, nails and gravel written into their limbs. His head is wizened like that of an old man. He is small for his age, thinner than he should be. He looks with eyes of one who has seen everything and does not need to turn away. This is what we have done to him.
A new series, but the feelings feel the same. Another.
The problem in the world is what is happening to children. It's the most critical problem of all. Children are being raised in war. They're being indoctrinated in ways that will shape their whole lives. That is the crime. That is the pain of what's happening in the world.
Has it always been this way?
Perhaps it has. I suppose, being an American, we always think things will get better. And I thought by the time I hit this old age that I would see things getting better, and I think they're not better.
I agree. So. Maybe this poem will detract us.
24 hours. I had 24 hours to erase from your body the crust of this world. Chaval, pity, you said, and we unwrapped each other like unlacing the threads which bind together the pages of a book, our hands touching and going away again, like touching a town on the map in the morning and then being there at nightfall.
That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Are these from literary journals that will become a book?
Most of these are in books, actually.
So are you still supplying poems to periodicals and journals, or don't you have time for that?
I haven't done much of that in recent times, just because of time. I don't know that world these days.
I know. And the online world is so prevalent that it seems that it takes 6 months to get in a small magazine, and then, 6 months for them, and then they send you back your issue, and time is so compressed, it all seems quaint.
Yes, it's a whole new world. I'm learning from my students about the online publishing. It's fascinating.
Time and space are compressed.
Absolutely. We're living in a very different time.
And we're expanded. How does this come together?
Well, my granddaughters the other night taught me how to do animation in PowerPoint.
Oh, mine. I'm trying to get out of office reply together. I think we would love a closing poem. A poem that you would say, I wish I had read that on the air. And you don't want to go away without. But I can see you don't have a favorite.
I don't.
Okay, we'll take... As Howard Nemiroff said, I love all of my children.
Maybe I'll read a poem by someone else.
Well, maybe we have time for both.
This is a wonderful poem by Wisława Szymborska, and I say that because I don't think anyone could write about 9/11 any better than she did. So here's her poem. A photograph from September 11th, Wisława Szymborska. They jumped from the burning stories down, one, two, a few more, higher, lower. A photograph captured them while they were alive and now preserves them above ground, toward the ground, each still whole, with their own face and blood well hidden. There is still time for their hair to be tossed and for keys and small change to fall from their pockets. They are still in the realm of the air, within the places which have just opened. There are only two things I can do for them: to describe this flight and not to add a final word.
And we will end with your own voice.
1941. You decide to crawl out from the haystack where you are hiding, to come up for air. Even the lowliest fish of the sea is allowed to pull the residue of air into its blood. For some it is too late, the pitchfork of the farmer pushed in and in, but you scramble to the top of a chimney pot where two storks have made their immense nest. You can be seen in the flat landscape. You take no trouble to conceal yourself. This is before the farmer raises his rifle, before your expulsion from this world into the next. You warm yourself among the storks, profit among birds, your world ajar. You read the sun trying to go down, the moon with its hem caught on the horizon. For a moment, in perfect stasis, high on your absurd perch, you are still breathing.
That is the voice of Myra Scleru. We're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Stay with us, and we will return. We're back at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. And now we're featuring Judith Farr, poet, novelist, biographer, scholar. She is the foremost Emily Dickinson scholar and Eleanor Wiley scholar and biographer. But first, we're going to hear a poem.
This is a poem that I wrote for Marianne Moore. It's called Loss. And it was inspired by a line from the Washington Post in October 20th, 2004. Many bird populations are in decline, data show. The greater prairie chicken is doing poorly. Here is the poem, Lost. If such news had been of nightingales, the lark, swan, dove, or bluebird, tears would have sprung to my eyes, while a dozen hallowed poems sang in my heart of tenderness, elegance, romance. As it is, the fate of the prairie chicken seems less disquieting. Bundling across the arid landscape in sullen brown, his rotundity a discouragement to flight, this prisoner of the desert, striped and shrill, lacks every glamour, while what commends him is mere enterprise. Should prairie chickens disappear, though, we would lose a worthy homeliness, an awkward plainness, a shabby industry that make beauty and ease all the more remarkable by contrast. I find myself looking again at him, recognizing the world and me.
That is the voice of Judith Farr. First, about Marianne Moore. She has been a big factor in your life. Tell the world who she was.
Well, she was a great American poet to begin with, one of the first early 20th century American women poets, and recognized as such during her lifetime. She was gallant. She was impeccably scholarly. Mm-hmm. She actually took a job as a librarian to enable her to write poetry quietly at home with her mother. She believed in literature, but she was also of something of a scientific bent, so she used to like to write poems about, oh, I don't know, whales, porpoises.
She discovered you in a way.
Well, yes, I was a little girl, really, in love with language, 14 years old in Manhattan, where I grew up. My father was a symphony musician, and my mother was very artistic, but both read greatly, and I fell in love with poetry. And there was a contest in New York City. It was funny. It was, I think, sponsored by the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. And the prize in the contest was if your poem won and you were a girl, you were able to have dinner with Marianne Moore. If you were a boy, you had dinner with Alan Swallow. So just for a lark, I sent in a poem, and I did win.
The Riverside Anthology. And she presented you the award.
Yes, she did. Yes, she did. And then she...
Your first publication.
That poem was my first publication, yes. Mm-hmm. Then a little bit after, I had a little poem in 17, which didn't sound like me. It sounded a little bit like Edna Millay and a little bit like
D.S. Eliot.
We all
did in the beginning. And so she took you under her wing in a way.
She did. Yes, she carted me around to a dinner. I remember it was a Penn dinner with Marilyn Monroe, who was newly married to Joe DiMaggio. And I remember Marianne saying, which was funny, she had a wonderful sense of humor. She said, if I went to my beautician every day, I could look like that. Meaning Marilyn Monroe, who really did look pretty striking, I can tell you. But yes, she was wonderful to me, and of course, she did give me some advice about writing, more than some. I still remember, although it's so many years ago now, but the first thing she said was, you must find your own voice. And the poems that you're writing now sound a little bit like different people, whatever it is that you're, whomever it is that you're reading at the time, which was of course true. And she said, so I want you to try to find what you think is your own voice. And then she said, since she asked me, she said, who is your favorite poet? And being tremendously stupid, I said, oh, Emily Dickinson. Of course, I could have said you know, but it didn't occur to me. It wouldn't really have been true. I admired her immensely, but I was in love with Emily. So that was what I said. And then, of course, she said, oh, that's bad. I said, why? She said, because she'll devour you.
And
she is so great. She will devour you, meaning I might never find my own voice.
Well, that's not true. You have found your own voice as a novelist, and that novel, I Never Came to You in White. You have found your own voice in many biographies. The Passion of Emily Dickinson is the zenith work on her life. Harvard University Press. The Life and Art of Eleanor Wiley was the first biography on her, I think, ever.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And, of course,
first long one.
The latest book, Gardens, the Gardens of Emily Dickinson, Harvard University Press, was awarded the Rose Mary Crawshay Prize of the Keats and Shelley Memorial Trust of the British Academy in 2005. Did you go over there?
Oh, we did. It was a great treat.
Oh, gosh.
They had a lovely prize-giving ceremony and read out a long account of the book. And my darling son came. His wife allowed him. He's a lawyer, but she forgave him the trip. She had to work, and we went over as a family, and the British were wonderful to me. I was the first American ever to get this award.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Since 1888. It was established in 1888 for the best book by a woman on some literary topic. And, you know, the British love Emily Dickinson.
Well,
and of course, they love their gardens. So I think the fact that it was on flowers had something to do with the award.
You have done more for Emily than she could have known. But you do have your own voice also, and so you're going to let us hear that now. This is Judith Farr, who is biographer, poet, novelist.
I do have a poem for Emily Dickinson, the only one I've written for her. This was written in 1971, and it's titled Remembering 28th August 1971. When the United States Post Office issued a stamp honoring Emily Dickinson. She was the queen recluse. In later years, her sister addressed her envelopes. Within a white shroud, the fine reticence endured. She wrote a taut hand, all wildness chiseled in an alphabet few housewives understood. A letter from Emily, whatever could it mean? Season's passion, passage, passion, bonneted or frank, memorials to absent friends, Emily of the upper stair, of the unseen window, fragrant with hyacinth. What would I have given for your letters? The conundrums of an eccentric spinster, the flood tides of the aesthetic mind. She distrusted photographs. At 17, her father made her sit for one. The quick ran from it, she said, right away. Her images were mental. She had a sister-in-law who loved publicity. Urgent, gentle, she lavished rhymes upon her, proving how above repute is genius. Mm. Nonetheless, some Dickinsons respected fame. If fame belonged to me, she countered sadly, I could not escape her. Indeed, now for the frigid garden, the unstinting room, here for the cherished silence and the lonely doom, we pay tribute. In the Billings Post Office in upstate New York, the old postmistress shares the stamps out. I read Emily Dickinson, she laughs, in school. They told us she was mad. Imagine. The day is further from summer than the birds, autumnal, elegiac. I pay and go. Oh, Emily, evanescent, light-spun, stern, how you would or would you stare to see yourself a plated person in my hand. You who relished ironies, opposites, the mail from Tunis or downstairs. Miss Dickinson of Amherst and of Ayr.
Oh, beautiful. That is Judith Farr on Emily Dickinson. So that was written in the 70s, and then in the 90s you went on to bring her to life in the most emphatic work about her life, I think, that exists. And that, The Passion of Emily Dickinson. Now, that title alone speaks absolutely from it's a heart connection with you.
Oh, yes.
So when you started, did you start with this passion? Tell me the very first thing you said. You woke up in the morning and said, I'm going to put together everything I know and start working on Emily. What was the first thing you had to do?
Well, I think I had to think more deeply than I had thought over the years about her relationship to her family and to other works of literature. It sounds like what anyone would do, but I had already written so much about her, many articles, many essays. I was not confident that people understood, or that it had been understood, what really moved her, what made her write. There was this mysterious master. I felt that through my work in American painting, I came to understand who the master was, who this man actually was. Many people had said it was Samuel Bowles, the editor of the Springfield Republican, to whom she wrote the most moving letters, and I decided that they were right, that this was indeed the case, but I had much additional proof, and I also had an understanding of how her sister-in-law affected her and what made her begin to write with such, and so many poems, hundreds of them, starting in about 1861. She had played with poetry through the 1850s, but it was in 1861.
How long did it take you to travel her road?
Well, many years.
Many years.
It was almost the work of a lifetime when I did it, because I had already done many, as I say, many essays, but this was a very long book.
Did you ever think, I am lost. I am lost in Emily. Where do I go? Or did you just have the stamina of a long-distance runner and just every day, how does the biographer get to the end?
I don't really know. Some people say they never do.
Mm.
And actually, I'm working now on a novel about the family, the women in the family of Robert E. Lee. And it seems like a strange departure, but he's also a 19th century figure. A descendant. My husband is a descendant of the Lees, and I became very interested in Mrs. Lee and the daughters and how
what
they
a
suffered.
Contribution
well, the way they be. Suffered through the Civil War was simply unbelievable. I mean, it was so painful. The loss of Arlington.
If
and
women
so on.
Will not write this, who will write this?
Well, that's sort of what I think. And of course, the same thing has happened to me with the Lees as happened with Emily. I became fascinated with their daily, with the indeed, the passion of their lives, and by this I mean Passio, suffering as well as, you know, the suffering of her life as well as the loves in her life.
Just to place you in history, I believe you were among the first women to be in the Yale graduate school ever.
Well, I think I was among the first, but mm-hmm. I was definitely the first woman teacher in a few places. Oh, dear.
So yeah. Pioneering is not new to you, but I don't want us to get lost in history and lose you.
Okay.
So we want to hear one more poem, and then I have many, many questions.
This is a poem that I wrote for another literary figure, but Emily Dickinson adored this figure, so in a way there's a connection. And this is Emily Bronte. Emily Bronte at my prep school. She always sat behind me, so I hoped she'd give me answers. But when a teacher ordered conjugate, she murmured, dream. When the blackboard shouted syntax, she whispered, passion. Her uniform was full of holes. A lilac-colored slip drooped below the hem. Concealed within her Thoreau's Walden, she kept a copy of Don Juan. Laughing softly to herself, she'd mouth a line or two. One day, the teacher noticed. Stand up before the class, he snapped. Compare and contrast the structures of Wuthering Heights and Mansfield Park. She blanched. I'd rather not, she said. Suddenly, a window opened wide. 30 shining angels, visitants of air, flashed into the room around her. Come along with me, she beckoned as they bore her up aloft. Terrified, I stayed behind to keep myself quite safe. I still remember how transfigured her wild hair streamed among the stars.
Oh, I love the way you can occupy another great woman in history. Eleanor Wiley, she was your first task. Now, when all of us grew up with Edna St. Vincent Millay and
yes.
Eleanor Wiley in our
yes.
generation. When I was researching the Poets Laureate of the United States for the Library of Congress, the women laureates had one thing in common, and that is that they were without ambition.
Uh-huh.
That was the one difference I saw, that they really didn't feel they were entitled to ambition.
Really? Yes.
Except for Louise Bogan, maybe. But
yes.
Eleanor Wiley was not a laureate. But she did have a kind
tremendous
of a subversive ambition.
Tremendous ambition. She left husbands for it.
Uh-huh.
And one child.
Yes.
And when my book came out, curiously, I remember a critic being quite, well, I thought offensive, because he would not have said this of a male figure. He said, how can Mrs. Farr claim that this is a fine writer, this woman, when she left her son and her first husband in order to be a writer? That wasn't quite true anyway. She left to elope with her second husband, but in the process, she was able to write much more. than Philip Hitchborn, the first husband, might have allowed her to do. And of course, one would not have criticized Shelley's poetry on the basis of his behavior towards wives. So it was quite wrong. I know, however, that ambition, for instance, I don't know if I should mention this, it may make people unhappy, but Marianne Moore counseled me never to marry. She said, you must not marry, because if you marry, of course she was unmarried, she said, you will have to give up the passion that belongs to a poet, to a man, and to your children.
But you found that was not true. Oh, you found no. You had enough to go around.
Oh,
you?
Yes.
Yes, you did.
And I would much rather, I won't say I would, I couldn't do without my husband and
absolutely,
child.
Absolutely, absolutely. Eleanor Wiley, though, was not popular, and so you really were breaking new ground with her. And her poetry was better than we thought.
Oh, it's very
good.
It's
very good. You said Theodore Retke was informed by it.
He was asked. He was asked, who has affected you most? He said, except for Shakespeare, Eleanor Wiley.
You were her first champion.
In a way, because, her papers, you see, were at Yale. Her last husband, William Rose Benet, had left the manuscripts to the Yale Library, and I was a student then. Early 60s, and I wanted to find something that was rare and special and new. I had already sort of done what I could at that time with Emily Dickinson with several essays, and so I decided to write a book about Eleanor Wiley.
Was she your dissertation?
Yes.
Oh,
yes,
good.
She was.
And it became a book.
Yes.
And her poetry, I was just rereading it in light of you coming here today.
Oh, how nice.
It's better. It gets better and better with the years, which is very funny.
Mm-hmm.
And not all of the women of that time, I can say that about.
No, that's very, very true. And some, if you look at an anthology like Lewis Untermeyer's, as you know, Grace, some of them have just fallen right out of the canon.
Mm.
But not many. Curiously enough, not so many.
Well, let us hear another poem by Judith Farr.
Well, this is about a place. This is about the Bronte Parsonage. I brought it because of the other poem. And the Bronte Parsonage, of course, is in Haworth in England. Hard to believe that so much passion seeded and bloomed here in three frail girls. This tight, spare house, so prim and measured,